Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and this is the Sunday Roundup. There are less than 4 weeks to go before polling day and the TV studios have been busier than ever. Last Friday saw a mass cyber attack that appeared to span the globe. In Britain, the most notable casualty was the NHS, where several non-emergency procedures were cancelled due to the confusion. The Defence Secretary Michael Fallon spoke to Andrew Marr about the aftermath and denied that the government had been lax on cyber security.
What patently this government has not properly invested in is defences against cyber attack. You did not give the NHS the proper support and the proper money to stop this cyber attack, with terrible results for patients up and down the country.
In our security review, just over a year and a few months ago, we identified cyber threats as one of the three principal threats, and we set aside £1.9 billion to protect us better against cyber, and a large chunk of that went to the NHS.
We're spending, you didn't pay the NHS, for the upgrade in 2015.
Hang on, we're spending around £50 million on the NHS cyber systems to improve their security. We have encouraged the NHS trusts to reduce their exposure to the weakest system, the Windows XP. Only 5%, less than 5% of the trusts actually use that system anymore.
Yes.
And there is money available to strengthen these systems.
But you did not pay for them to strengthen that system at the crucial moment in 2015, did you?
That was an old system. We didn't want them to use that. We wanted them to use modern systems that are better protecting. No, we warned them and they were warned again in the spring.
So it's they were warned again of the threats. Not of the government, is that what you're saying?
Well, we all have to work at this. The NHS wasn't particularly targeted. The same attacks applied to Nissan on Friday and in other areas of the economy and indeed around the world. But let me just assure you, we are spending money on strengthening the cyber defence of our hospital system.
Meanwhile, Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell outlined his latest policy idea to Sky's Sophie Ridge, the introduction of a Robin Hood tax, which would target financial transactions made by banks and hedge funds.
All we're trying to do is correct a loophole. This isn't about punishing anyone, but it is about saying to the banks and the hedge funds that actually where they're speculating, the most risky speculation in derivatives, we want them to make a contribution. Just fair, a fair contribution, very small. We're saying 0.02%, not even the same level as other transactions.
Well, one person who disagrees with you on this is Labour's mayor in London, Sadiq Khan. We'll have a look at what Sadiq Khan has previously said about this. Yeah. People will just go to other parts of the world where there is no financial transaction tax. And he also described the idea as madness. And you can see why, because in the year to March 2016, the City of London contributed 11% of all tax revenue.
Yes,
I mean, that's
course.
A big gamble.
It is, but we're talking to a tiny fraction more. And when Sadiq was saying that, at that point in time, the European system had stalled. It hasn't now. It's moved on quite swiftly. So I think circumstances have changed. Now is the right time to do it. This is a small transactional tax. We're asking a small contribution from the city. You know, look, we bailed out the city 10 years ago when the crash came. We poured hundreds of billions of pounds into it. Since then, £100 billion has been given out in tax, in bonuses in the city. So we're asking for a small contribution to them. What to do to fund our public services, to make sure our children are educated, to make sure we have a decent health service. It's not much to ask, you know.
An unavoidable feature of this election campaign has been what happened next in the upcoming Brexit negotiations. Brexit Secretary David Davis told Robert Peston that there were many disagreements yet to come.
So, do you accept the structure that they put on these talks broadly, that you have to talk about money, migrants and Ireland before you get on to trade?
Not entirely, and that'll be the first discussion.
So which bit of that don't you accept?
Well, money and Ireland, basically. I mean, the European Union citizens in the UK, British citizens abroad, we all accept needs to be dealt with as fast as possible.
And can I just ask, they think that this could be all wrapped up by the early autumn on the rights of citizens.
Yeah.
Do you think it could all be wrapped up?
Yes.
Because they have laid out that they want to guarantee all rights, pension rights, health rights and all the rest of it, which is what people were saying in the Leave campaign.
Yes.
So that could be wrapped up quite quickly.
I think so. I mean, there will be arguments over fine detail.
Like what?
Well, like whether the European Court of Justice oversees these rights after we've left.
Is that a fine detail? Because talking again to Brussels officials, they say the European Court of Justice has to oversee those
rights.
And
we'll have an argument about that. We'll have an argument about that.
Are you prepared to accept that at all?
No, we're not. And you know, the simple truth is we're leaving. You know, we are going to be outside the reach of the European Court. We're going to be outside the reach of all of the lawmaking capability.
So just to be clear, if an Italian who's lived there for a bit has a dispute over the pension that we pay him, you don't want the European Court of Justice to be able to adjudicate?
No, I mean, I don't think there will be such a dispute, to be honest. I mean, what we're after is a very generous outcome. In effect, what we're trying to do is to get a circumstance which effectively freezes the rights that people already have. So they will have the rights to welfare, they'll have the rights to health, they'll have the rights to pensions, as they would if they were a permanent resident here anyway. The only rights they wouldn't have are those sort of citizenship rights and the right to vote in the general election.
So that's one important disagreement. Sorry,
but the point is that there are many, many ways of guaranteeing this. We don't see a need to sort of give in to the European ideology on the European Court of Justice. We've got very good courts. In fact, I take slight offence to the argument that the Supreme Court couldn't oversee this.
Nicola Sturgeon found herself discussing a topic close to her heart with Andrew Marr this morning, but this time it wasn't Scottish independence. Instead, Marr quizzed her about the state of Scottish education.
I know how important a good education has been to me in my life. I want every young person in Scotland to have the best education. The vast majority of young people in Scotland do get the best of education, but there are areas where we need to do better, and I am not shying away from that.
And yet, under the SNP, something serious has gone wrong. Scotland used to be one of the most best-educated countries in the world.
On many measures, it
and
still
you have all
is.
The powers. You have all the powers to change this, and yet things are going backwards.
Well, on literacy and numeracy, we have a particular challenge, but on many other measures of Scottish education, that is just not true. We are not going backwards.
Literacy and numeracy are kind of important.
I think you're trying to conduct this information at this interview on the basis that I'm being defensive here. I'm not being defensive. I absolutely readily accept the areas where we need to do better. That's why we have put such effort into the initiatives and the reforms that we are taking forward. And the point I was going to make earlier on, which I didn't get the chance to finish, is that we are actually introducing more transparency so that I can be held more to account. So instead of sample surveys like the ones we've got, we will have information on every pupil in Scotland at the required levels, broken down, not just by local authority, but school by school, so that there'll be no hiding place for any politician on the performance of Scottish education.
And you said not so long ago that you wanted to be judged by this and your neck would be on the line.
Absolutely. And
you're looking a little Mary Queen of Scots at the moment on that
subject. I don't wish to be Mary Queen of Scots. Look, I've been First Minister for 2.5 years and I said when I became First Minister that this was what I wanted to be the defining priority of however many years I am First Minister, and I hold to that. So by the time that we're at the next Scottish election, I want to see improvement. And, you know, we're talking about literacy and numeracy. The other big challenge we've got in Scotland, which again is not unique to Scotland, is to close the attainment gap between the richest and the poorest young people.
And we're very focused on... And you're still behind England on that?
Well, on some measures, and we don't measure it in exactly the same way. You and I have had the discussion about university entrance before, where the measurements are different in Scotland and England. But in a sense, I'm not sitting here wanting to make those comparisons. I want Scotland to be the best on its own terms.
The Shadow Business Secretary, Rebecca Long-Bailey, raised a few eyebrows when she appeared on the Sunday Politics, speaking to Andrew Neil about Labour's borrowing plans.
Now, you plan to borrow an extra £25 billion a year, John McDonnell's already announced this, on public investment. That's on top of the around £50 billion that's already being planned for investment. You're going to borrow it all. So that means, I think, if you can confirm, that many, many years after the crash, by 2021, 2022, a Labour government would still be borrowing £75 billion a year. Is that correct?
What we've set out is £250 billion of capital investment and £250 billion for a national investment bank. Now, our financial and fiscal rules dictate that we will leave the government in a state of less debt than we found it at the start of the parliament. So we aren't going to increase the national debt at the end of our parliamentary term.
Well, how can you do that, though, if by 2021... you will still be borrowing about £75 billion a year, which is more than we borrow at the moment.
As I said, the £500 billion figure is set out over a period of 10 years. Now, this is a figure that's been suggested by Dieter Helm from Oxford University as a figure that's necessary to bring us in line with our other industrial competitors. Similar figures have been suggested by groups such as the CBI. We simply have to invest in the tools that businesses need to grow and thrive.
And finally, Michael Gove gave as good a sign as any that he would like to return to government. Having previously said that Theresa May was right to sack him last July, Gove went one step further.
Now, you've been very loud and clear in this interview with your praise for Theresa May. You're clearly a fan of the work she's doing. Do you think she's doing a better job than you would have done if you'd been elected?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Leader? Why is that?
Well, I think that, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. The demonstration of the way in which Theresa has made all the major calls on Brexit successfully, the obvious popularity that she enjoys, the stability and strength that she's brought to that role, all of these reflect incredibly well on her judgment and her leadership abilities. And so all I can do is take a step back and admire the way in which she has, on the economy, on education and on Europe, shown a degree of consistency and clarity as leader. There's something else as well. During my leadership run, brief as it was, one of the things that I tried to articulate was the need for the Conservatives to do more for people on average and below average incomes. And actually, to be fair to Theresa, she was onto this issue before me, and she's delivered on this issue far more energetically, I think, than anyone could have expected any Conservative leader could have done. And the result of that focus on ordinary working families has been popularity in the polls, but also a Conservative Party bringing forward proposals, including on areas like new council housing, that reflect the interests of the overwhelming majority.
That's all for this week. I'm Isabel Hardman, and this podcast was produced by Matthew Taylor. Don't forget to subscribe to the Coffee House Shots podcast on the iTunes store, and you can receive a special election offer of 6 issues of The Spectator for £6 at spectator.co.uk/election offer.